Talking Landscape Photography with Kristen Fletcher and Carwin.
And we're joined by a very special gentleman today who has been described as Australia's Peter Lick. Actually, there's quite a lot wrong with that statement, isn't there?
Are we talking about Christian here or are we talking about me?
Tom Putt, welcome to Like-Minded. How are you going, mate?
I'm very well, thanks, Carwin. Yourself?
Oh, punching away. COVID-ridden world.
He's got his John Deere hat on. Tom's got a beanie on because it's obviously cold and full of coronavirus where he's coming from. And I'm sitting here with an imminent storm about to lash us. So we get
our weather from you guys, so I'm just blaming it on you.
Oh, yeah, you do.
It's freezing cold here today.
All the stinky West Australian air comes across. All those...
We have to clean it up by the time it gets over to New Zealand, bro.
Why do you think you've got so much COVID over there, mate? Because we just keep coughing in your general direction.
If I cough today, it's because I do genuinely have a little bit of a cold, which is a worry.
Oh.
If I cough sooner.
What is the GO there at the moment? Because we're hearing stuff that Victoria are going to bring in restrictions again.
We're back again.
Is that what the prevailing vibe's like? It's like... You know, here we go again. Is that what it feels like? Or?
The word on the street, I don't think is too bad. I think we're trying to just avoid any conversation around it all and pretend nothing's really happening.
Should we talk about footy instead?
Let's talk about Mighty Blues beating Geelong down in Geelong on Saturday night, eh?
How long has the AFL got left in it, do you reckon?
I don't know. They must be shitting their pants as well, I reckon, they've sort of like talked about this possibly happening and now it is happening. They're probably going, oh, God, could this year get any worse for us?
Yeah, it's a Barry Crocker, that's for sure.
Well, I think you guys are just disappointed because the Eagles are playing like shit. So it's not my fault. Not my fault.
Hey, the Eagles are all on hydroxychloroquine. They're fine, mate. They're fine.
Right. Is that the same thing that Trump was taking, was it?
Yeah, that's right. They've got other things in their system, but COVID.
I can give you full stats that 19 cases in Victoria yesterday, 4 cases were from return travellers, 10's a local transmission from an unknown source, and 4 are from known sources existing already. It's all happening over
here. We know who the unknown source is. Now that you've got a cold.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, mate. I'll self-isolate for 2 weeks, which means that I can just not work for 2 weeks, which would be lovely.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I would go that shit if I had to do that. So.
Yeah. Now, mate, we're not here to talk about a deadly pandemic that's ripping the world a new one. We're here to talk about you, mate. Tom,
let's talk. How about less of you talking about me and more of me talking about me?
Yeah. That works. I'm just going to go off and do the dishes now for half an hour.
Just let it run. You guys don't need to talk at all.
What's that quote? That one that you just played for me, Carmen, a minute ago. I'd rather make dinner with a mum or with a mum.
Are we talking about the great man? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's start with that.
Well, you know, if Tom, if the shot's not good enough.
Mate, we'll pack up, go home and help mum in the kitchen.
such a modern man, Peter Lick.
Yeah.
Hey, look, what's that song by from?
That's Licky.
Is that Licky?
Yeah. Yep.
Jeez, mate, looking over the edge there makes me puke. Whoa.
Where did you grab this from? From YouTube?
Carmen got it from somewhere. Yeah, he's a radio guy.
You guys have been paying out on him as well, have you?
No, of course not. No, save that for this way.
We've actually tried to get him on the show.
Seriously?
But for some reason. They were too busy.
Yeah, too busy for us.
That guy is apparently, he's really hard to nail down. I won't say who or what, but... that somebody got in to do some work for him, and it was an unpaid gig, and in the end they had to really cut back the work and just basically say, look, if you can condense it into an hour, I reckon you'll probably get in to do it. But aside from that, he just won't sit still for 5 minutes. He reminds me a lot of you, Christian. He's got ADHD.
What are you talking about? I'm very relaxed. But no, come on, let's talk about you, Tom.
Let's talk about Christian for a second. He decides that he's going to come over here to Bright to shoot the autumn colours, and he comes over with a Marky Mark, and he goes, he blames it all on Mark. Oh, Mark's travel agent booked the wrong flights, which I think meant Christian booked the cheap ass flights. Yeah. And they arrived at 5 to midnight, and he goes, you're still going to come and pick us up from the airport, aren't you? And I said, Yeah, of course. But like, where are we going to stay that night? Well, we thought we'd just drive straight from the airport up to Bright. You know, it's only a 3.5 hour drive. Mm. So that's what we do. He forces me to drive all the way up there, you know, like a chauffeur up to Bright. 3.5 hours later, we get to bed at like 3:34 in the morning. And then Christian's like rattling in the tin at 5:30, 6 o'clock going, come on, everyone, let's get up for a sunrise shoot.
Seriously.
We've had 2 hours.
Admittedly, it was a rough start. And remember that truck? Remember that truck, that truck driver that was swerving all over the road when we were going up on the highway? And we had to really slow down, and you had to try and get past this guy without us getting T-boned by this massive truck. But yeah, I remember that trip. That was awesome. I'm still selling images from that trip.
Well, that was the day, and I actually stood and looked over your shoulder, and I think I commented something along the lines of, what the hell are you doing taking that photo for? Where you took one of my most favourite photographs of yours, which is still hanging in the foyer at CPL here in South Melbourne, of those beautiful autumn leaves on the ground with those water droplets on it.
That's right.
Looks like it's shot in a studio with just perfect, beautiful, subdued lighting. And I hate saying that about a lot of your work, you know that, but you are a photographer. It's one of my favourite images. Bloody brilliant. Yeah. I'll acquire that one day, I hope.
Yeah. Oh, mate, you just tell me, mate, and I'll send it over.
Tom, tell us about you. When did you first pick up the camera?
Right. I was about 13 years old. My dad was a very keen photographer, and I lent his Minolta XG9, I think it was, you know, obviously all pretty much. It's kind of like a semi-auto thing, you know, like I don't think it was so old that it had the needle in the viewfinder, but he still does, very keen interest in photography. He takes his camera everywhere, takes photos of everything, probably more photos than I do. He lent me that, and I was into bird watching and bird photography through that.
Yeah.
And feathered variety. I was a late bloomer, I should say. So, you know, I didn't get interested in any other birds until later on. But that's where it all started, basically. So I was volunteering for a wildlife organization. We'd go out every couple of weeks and catch, band, and release birds, migratory waders that fly from Siberia down to Australia every year and then back again. And the guy who was heading all of that up was very keen photographer as well. So he sort of took me under his wing and sort of mentored me through those early years.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. And so when did you start becoming like this was going to be my career? Did it start straight away, or did you spend a bit of time ginning around?
This is where I pay out on Ken Duncan. And I've told him this already, so I'm quite happy to say it. I met him sort of officially at the Focus Awards a couple of years ago in Sydney, and I said, Ken, I know we've met before, but I've got a beef with you. I said, you owe me a lot of money. And he said, oh, ha-ha, why is that? And I said, well, I walked into your gallery back in Melbourne in, I think it was April 1997 it was, and I saw his beautiful artwork on the walls and saw that it was a commercial reality. You know, I think up until then, and I had it in my head that photography or landscape photography, I should say, was something that you did as a hobby, but you could never make it a career because, you know, photographic books that I'd looked at that had photographs of national parks of Australia and stuff were mostly taken by photographers who were hobbyists, you know, keen bushwalkers who happened to just carry a camera with them and not even right place, right time, because more often than not, they weren't great photographs. They were sort of taken middle of the day when you'd summit the mountain and, you know, take it in bright, broad daylight, but at least they got the shot because there was nothing else, right?
Yeah.
And yet walking into Ken's gallery, I went, oh my God, like, look, you can sell artwork and sell these photos and make a career out of it like Ken was doing. And so that just set me on this journey of the last 23 years, traveling all over Australia, you know, acquiring these images that may never be seen by anybody, to be honest. You know, you do get to the point like now where I say to myself, how many more photographs do I need to take? I mean, I'm looking at my gallery now. I've got, you know, 12, 13 large format photographs on the wall, and yet we've got over 1,000 on the website for sale. So I do love that. I do obviously love taking photographs, and I love being outdoors, but also there becomes a commercial reality where you say to yourself, well, of all these beautiful photographs am I taking, am I ever going to sell any of them, you know, or some of them, or just a few, or what have you? Christian knows what I'm talking about.
Well, I think the key is you have to die. And then
yes. Well, I almost did a couple of weeks ago, speaking of, you know, Christian talking about me negotiating the truck up the Hume Freeway about 10 years ago, I think it was. My beautiful van, since I opened the gallery here 18 months ago, my car died. And I said to my partner, Mary, I said, I think I'm going to get a van, a moving van, to be able to deliver this artwork to a client. I love the idea that they would purchase something here in the gallery. I would sell it to them. I'd tell them the story and they'd fall in love with it. And then to finish the sale off, wouldn't it be great to be able to deliver the artwork to them and hang it for them, which we do.
Yeah.
And I said to her, I'm going to buy a van to do that with. And we had it wrapped. It's a beautiful Renault Traffic van. We had it wrapped. And then I hit a kangaroo 4 weeks ago going to a shoot.
Oh, no.
Peninsula, and I think I chose the largest kangaroo here on the Mornington Peninsula. Probably stands about as tall as you and I on each other's shoulders, and I was going 100 kilometres an hour, which was the speed limit.
Man,
and I had no time to react other than to brace and somewhat slam on the brakes. But I hit this guy fair and square right in front of me, and if he had jumped any higher, he would have come through the windscreen and I probably wouldn't be standing here.
Can I just qualify that statement just for our United States listeners? You hit a kangaroo in a car doing 100 Ks, you're going to have a very long day. These animals are massive. Some of them weigh, 50 or 60 kilograms, which is, 120 pounds. So imagine hitting that at, 60 miles an hour. Anyway, it's good to...
Or if you're in America, you're doing 100 miles an hour.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, which is 160 Ks. But was the van...
cop chasing you in pursuit.
And then still stop at the Macca's drive-thru. Sorry,
yeah, that's right. Fall asleep.
My car wasn't going anywhere after that.
Was it totaled?
That poor kangaroo.
Was it totaled?
Look, it probably damaged about 50% of the engine because the engine sits to the front and it's got a bit of a nose, this van. No bumper bar, of course, because it'd look dicky on a van like that. Mm. The van sort of drifted for about another 30, 40 metres up the road. I pulled off by the side of the road and then it just said, no, I'm not going any further. Mm. And I called the towie and the tow truck and, it's $12,000 worth of damage. They're rebuilding the engine as we speak.
Hopefully it's insured.
Yes, absolutely, 100%. I've got a very good insurer who covers me for everything. And that, as well as the beautiful wrap that I put on the van, which is, $4,000's worth, is insured also. Yeah. So, it's
pain in the ass.
It's not pleasant. It gives you the shock of your life. And really, I think the split second that I braced on impact, I thought this is not going to end well. And I wasn't perhaps talking about the kangaroo. Mm. I was talking about me as well. I just thought, wow, this couldn't get any worse, really. So, this is a big kangaroo that's right in front of me and I can't go anywhere. And there's no point swerving because you're probably not going to miss it. And if you swerve at 100 kilometres an hour, you're going to end up, doing yourself more damage.
Well, you're not
supposed
to.
Rolling the thing, what have you. So I've always learned my instinct is to just keep going straight ahead and brace. Mm. I've hit a few kangaroos in my time and nothing as bad as this. I mean, I do a lot of driving and I do a lot of driving at night, sometimes coming back from shoots interstate, in the country areas, et cetera. But this was bad. Anyway.
Yeah. So, it's terrible. I mean, I think I've killed about 5 kangaroos in my time being down here. And, it's funny because my brother told me one time, he said, Christian, we're on our way to Nanup. He goes, Christian, slow down because there's so many kangaroos down here. You're going to hit a bloody kangaroo. Slow down, mate. It's like, whatevs. Yeah. Bang, hit the kangaroo. Thank you very much.
Did you injure yourself at all or just no dramas?
Not at all. And in fact, a few of the people who sort of knew what happened were calling me later in the day saying, are you still okay? You're all right? Because it can be, that sort of delayed sort of some sort of injury, et cetera. But no, nothing at all, which was amazing. Thank goodness I'm standing here today.
I'm starting to build a bit of a picture, mate, because there was an episode I remember where you dropped, was it a camera into the water off it? Tell us about that.
What are you trying to say here? You're trying to say that I'm accident prone?
No, maybe the insurers need to know a bit more about this. Go on.
Wow, this is the other thing, Christian would know this. I've contacted Christian well over the years about, buying a medium format digital camera and wanting to, having camera envy. A lot of things I'm envious about Christian about, but we won't mention it here on the show. But
my grey hair.
That's it. On your head. Yeah. So I have always talked to him about getting a Phase 1, and then Pentax came out with that, 645Z, and for $10,000 to get into the medium format digital game, that was very enticing for me. So I bought a second hand one a few years ago, and I was doing a night photo shoot. It was a workshop down here on the peninsula doing steel wool, you know, the spinning of the steel wool. Mm. And we'd done three or four different locations, and this was the last, literally the last shot of the night. And there's three of us standing on this pier, and I'm standing behind the other two guys. And it was quite windy, so I was hanging onto the tripod, and for whatever reason, I let go. And the next thing you know, I hear this splash in the water next to the pier. And there's my camera and my tripod in the water with the LCD screen on the back of the Pentax lighting up Port Phillip Bay, you know, like
underwater.
Underwater. And I'm looking, just going, how the hell did that happen? How did my camera and tripod end up in the water? What had happened was I was using a temporary tripod at the time, and it was an old one, and the clasp, the plastic clasp,
It gave away.
Yeah. So the whole thing had just fallen over. And so I dived into the water. Of course, I had my mobile phone in my pocket, and I dived in the water. I grab it, I put it up on the pier, and I had no idea how deep the water was, by the way. And sort of, you know, just cursed for the rest of the night, and then rang my insurer the next morning and said, by the way, is my camera, that beautiful camera of mine, is that insured for saltwater damage? And he said, yep, you have 100%. Why? What's happened? And I told him, and he goes, sorry to hear that. And I had to replace it. But yeah, that was not a fun evening. One of the worst days of my life.
I can sympathize with that. But luckily, you don't need to go to medium format anymore, mate. You can just go get yourself a Leica SL2 with the new high resolution mode. Sorry, just putting a little plug there.
When you would know this, that Christian doesn't mention any sort of photographic product unless he's being endorsed in some way, shape, or form, unless there's some sort of kickback.
That is so true, Tom. That is just completely accurate.
Come on, what is this?
Times over the years, I've heard him mention like Sigma Quattro or Capture One or this or that. You know, like he just he's not peddling it unless he's getting money in his pocket for every time he mentions
it.
Hey, Tom, you've been winning awards, mate, since 2003.
Yes. First year I entered the AIPP awards, I wasn't even a member. I wasn't even a member I entered. I won four silvers that year. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. I didn't even go to the judging. I just rocked up and went, oh, there's my photo on the wall. Oh, there's another one. How come? Oh, I won four silver awards. That's nice.
Yeah,
they were the days that you could win awards for straight-up panoramic photographs, like straight out of the camera.
Yeah. Go on. I mean, you've won so many awards, all sorts of bloody, all over the place. I mean, the most recent one's the Panoramic Photographer of the Year, Fine Art Awards.
Yeah.
I mean, so do you think that you know, you need to enter awards? Is that something that people should aspire to? Is that something that helps you with your work and you know, help you refining your images, or what's the story behind awards for you?
I think there's many schools of thoughts around this. Some people like to enter awards because they feel it pushes them creatively. It pushes them to perhaps learn new processing techniques so that they can then perhaps do better in awards. It pits them, I guess, up against their peers and sees where they stand. I do it for probably one reason over the other, and that's because running a commercial gallery like this, I think, immediately can build rapport with clients who, or customers who have never heard of you before.
Mm, yeah.
So if they're walking into a gallery, it's like, let me say this, like on the door of our gallery here, we have a list of my most recent awards. And also it's repeated on the back wall here of the gallery behind me now. And when you drive past a hairdresser and you see, you know, 2020 Hairdresser of the Year and numerous other awards, it immediately, without even knowing them, immediately you think, well, they must be half decent because they've won all those awards.
That's the hairdresser I would go to, definitely.
This is it. This is it. And so I think when you're making an investment, and I use investment in a loose term, in art, I think there's so many things that people sort of question when they going through that decision-making process, which is, do I like it? Will it suit my home? But also, too, I think around the idea of, is this artist any good? Am I buying something that's justifiable for the $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 price tag? I mean, Christian's obviously artwork is a lot more than that. But
$60,000, $70,000
for an 8x10. But, you know, I think it does immediately sort of give people that confidence, perhaps, that they're making the right decision. So, look, I do it for that reason, but I also do it because I do enjoy, obviously, from an egotistical point of view, that thrill of winning an award, and more recently the one in America last year. If you'd said to me even 10 years ago that, Tom, you're going to win an award that would take you over to New York to accept that award, I would just go, not possible. Like, why would they select me out of all the brilliant photographers in Australia, let alone the world? So that was a big thrill and a big opportunity to go over to New York, a place that I'd never been to before and always wanted to. So, it opens doors, I guess you'd say, as well.
Do you think you're an overnight success, Tom? Because a lot of people look at someone that's got a gallery and go, oh, man, this guy's just started up and he's just opened a gallery. You know, what's that? But do you, what do you say to people that say, oh, you know, how did you get so late?
A loose family friend of mine who's very well off, once said, and he said this many years ago, and it's always stuck in my head, that an overnight success takes about 15 years.
So
when you see overnight successes and you go, geez, where have these guys come from, you generally probably got to say, well, they've probably worked about 15 years, maybe more, in order to become that overnight success, in inverted commas. So as I said to you, it's been my dream. I've been photographing landscapes, or at least been interested in photographing landscapes, since I took up photography, which was 33 years ago. And I've been interested and had a desire to want to open my own gallery since I walked into Ken's gallery 23 years ago. So this opened 18 months ago. It took me 20 years to get to this point. So my overnight success only took me 20 years. I was probably a bit delayed. I should have got it done a few years earlier.
Well, you said you're a bit of a slow learner, mate, with the birds. And now with the galleries.
When you walked into Ken's gallery, did you ever imagine that you would be putting out stuff to that level?
I probably hoped so. I'm a pretty driven kind of guy, and I probably could relate more to Christian's work, in a sense that he came on my radar pretty early as well, and I bought his books and really admired his stuff as well. I don't know that I even am at that level. I'm pretty humble about the work that I put out, and I'm pretty, it's funny because people walk into the gallery and they go, oh geez, your house, your home, you must have plenty of your own stuff on the walls, and I'd probably prefer to hang other people's work. Christian's, I've got a piece of Christian's that I bought from him, and what I'm trying to say is I pretty much underrate my work. And so for people to acquire it, I guess, to walk into the gallery here and go, wow, I love that, I'd hang that on my wall, that's very complimentary. And I think that's, I'm not saying a feather in my cap, I just, it still blows me away that people want to do that.
Whose stuff have you got on your own walls? You've got some of Christian's stuff, probably Peter Eastway as well.
I don't have a Peter Eastway on my wall. But I need to. I tell you what, we're renting at the moment and there's limited wall space. So I like the idea of perhaps having my own beautiful dream home, like Christian's multi-story mansion, and having my walls plastered with people's artwork that I admire. I've got a little bit of Damien Bredberg on my wall. I know Damien personally. Michael Scott Lees, I've got his beautiful snow gum picture on my wall. So, but there's plenty of other stuff that is rolled up in tubes that I haven't had framed yet that will make the walls one day, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, mate, you, I reckon, probably the first photographer in the country, if not the world, running photography workshops.
No, that's not true. I started back in 2005, and at that stage I knew of only two others running photographic workshops along similar lines, which was Darren Leal and Richard White. And so those two guys were running workshops at the time, and I got the idea because I was buying – the way I taught myself photography years ago back in the sort of early mid-90s was going to the newsagents. This is for the younger people listening to this podcast. This was before the internet. I know that's a weird concept to get your head around, but there were days where we didn't have internet, and I would go to the newsagents and I'd buy all these magazines, and one out of the states called Outdoor Photographer I would buy every month because it was so heavily involved with landscape photography. And in the back of it had all these ads, and in the ads there was obviously ads for B&H and Cambridge and these other camera shops that I would just, you know, highlight all the different cameras and lenses that I wanted to own. But then there was also all of these photographic workshops. And I'm like, what's this photographic workshop thing? And so I sort of did a bit of research and then realized that that was something that I wanted to do because I love teaching photography and I felt I had something to offer. Mm. And as a little selfish side note, and I probably should admit this, we just started a family and I thought I'm never going to get out and take landscape photographs again if I don't have an excuse to do it, or at least perhaps that's a way I can get it past the wife at the time that I can say, hey, look, it's work. I'm earning money from this. I need to go and run these workshops and get out and about and take photographs. So
it's a boys trip, mate. No such thing as,
It's a hell of a lot of fun. I probably enjoy it more now than anything else because I was talking to my participants about this yesterday. I'm more confident than ever about what I teach. I think I've got better at teaching over the years. I have got better at verbalizing my thought processes and why I'm standing where I am in order to take this photograph. And so I talk them through that as well. And so, yeah, I still love doing it all these years later.
How do you, what's your approach to teaching people, I guess the exposure, the triangle, how do you get that across to people? Because it's something that you know, but it's quite difficult to impart.
I don't know that I do it as well as I could. At the end of the day, I try and give them these hard and fast rules. So if you're new to photography and you're saying to yourself, I don't understand the settings and that's I think the foundation. I think I'm not big on the technical side of things because I haven't studied photography formally. So I've taught myself what I need to know and I teach my participants what they need to know. I think the idea is that you don't bombard them with too much information. Mm. Don't get too technical on them. But I think also it's about just saying, right, what are you wanting to achieve here? And they say, well, I want this photo to be, I want back to front focus. So I go, right, set the camera to F16 because the larger the f-stop number, the more you'll get in focus. And they go, oh, okay. And I say, just put that aside, And no, we're on a tripod. We can set the ISO. What do you reckon to? Well, probably lower because it's got better quality. Yeah, correct. ISO 100, I try and ask as many questions as possible so they can try and figure it out for themselves because really what I'm trying to do on all my workshops is teach them how to fish rather than me fishing for them. There's no point me just telling the numbers and saying, look, don't worry about it. Just trust me on this one. That'll work for you. I'm saying to them, right, this is why. And I'm challenging them and I teach them in the first few hours. So I run a one-day workshop here on the Mornington Peninsula, right? And we spend a half a day shooting. And I'll teach them at the start what to have the settings on. But then later in the day, I'll be saying to them, you tell me what you think you should have set on. So I can test their level of understanding and knowledge.
Well, I've done a workshop with you in the past, mate. We're down to Mornington Peninsula, and what I really love about that workshop is that you're a lot of fun to be around, and you put on a good show. You give people the knowledge that they need, but it's also entertaining and a good time. And I think that's why you get repeat customers, and you're so popular with the workshops because, you don't want to go with somebody that's just a stick in the mud. Want someone that can laugh and entertain you, and that's part of
it. Part of it all. It's part of the whole package. At the end of the day, I was saying to the participants yesterday, I was looking through, I still subscribe to a bird watching magazine that comes out quarterly. It sounds very geeky.
Penthouse.
No, that's monthly, not quarterly. And so I was looking at the ads in that magazine, and I'm saying to myself, I might one day want to go off and do a photographic bird photography workshop. And there's again a lot of these ads, and I'm saying to myself, how would I choose based on all these ads? It's difficult, and that's the same dilemma that my prospective clients have with looking at all these workshops that are available now. And that's a good thing that there's so many around. But you do hear the good and the bad stories. You do hear of those people who might have great photographs on their website advertising a workshop, but they can't teach, or they don't pay the level of attention to their workshop participants as they should. And so for me, I'd be looking at it in terms of, right, where are you going? Do I love the location? What does the workshop leader, what's their photographs like? Am I going to love their photographs? Because that will hopefully be something that I get. But then I think thirdly, most importantly, it's kind of around the lines of, am I going to enjoy hanging out with this person? Am I going to have a great experience? Because you are literally spending 12, 15, 18 hours a day with this person. It's like, Christian, you're on first thing in the morning as soon as you wake up. You're there with them. You're meeting them for sunrise. You're entertaining them the whole day long, all the way up until you go to bed at night. And so they've got to be, in my mind, it's got to be somebody that fun that you like hanging around, because it's going to be a pretty long and horrible workshop if you can't get along with the workshop leader, you know, you don't like their personality or they rub you up the wrong way or whatever, you know, you just hope you have a great time.
And you do. You meet all sorts, all personality types, and you've almost got to be a psychologist a lot of the time when you're out doing these things, because you get to understand that this person, okay, this person's that way and this person's that way, and this person needs more help, this person needs less help, this person wants to work independently, this, you know, this person likes, what's that buddy kid's fairy tale thing? This kid likes roast beef, this kid likes none. Right. the little piggies.
It's been a few years since you had to tell that one.
I know my kids are teenagers.
I have another one.
Yeah, but
she feels the same way about kids as I do, I think.
Who's that? My wife.
Oh, you do.
I mean, oh yeah, I love my
he
kids.
He loves his kids. He loves, yeah, loves
I,
his
I couldn't eat a whole one. That's a joke my mates came up with. I thought it's quite funny. So look, you know, your workshops, you travel all over the world. Where has been the most awesome place that you have traveled to take photographs? And I reckon you're going to say the Faroe Islands.
It's interesting because I get asked that fairly often as well, as, you know, well, what's the favorite photograph? What's your best photograph you've ever taken? Or what's your favorite location to go and shoot? It's hard. It's like choosing which is your favorite child. I mean, clearly.
That's easy.
My son.
Super easy.
Yes. The one who's not causing me the most trouble at the time.
Always the girl.
That can be out of my two as well as Mary's other three. So, Carwin, just to let you know, we've got five kids between us, Mary and I, and they're teenagers now. Crikey. All teenagers. And when people say five, God, what are their ages? I just easily rattle it off. I go 17, 16, 15, 13, 12. I can't count backwards. 17, 16, 15, 14, 13. There you go. Yeah. That's embarrassing. Not another coffee. But literally, there's like roughly 1 year apart between all five of them. We've got four girls and a boy. They're amazing kids. It's challenging at times, as you can imagine. My favorite place that I've taken a workshop or run a workshop, I reckon probably more recently would have to be Lake Baikal in Russia, which is in Siberia, Russia. North of the Mongolian border. And I think that's quite incredible because A, it's so remote, B, it's in Russia, so I never thought I'd really get to Russia, C, being on the world's largest and deepest freshwater lake, driving on it in a car in the middle of winter with, you know, a meter of ice below you, but equally so another 1.6 kilometers at its deepest below you of just black water, is quite an experience. And then being out there in minus 20 degrees each and every day is incredible. So yeah, that's an amazing place to go.
We asked Andre Juman this the other week. Do you think there is anywhere left in Australia, or certainly in the world, that hasn't been photographed, or that that is worthy of some amazing photography?
Yes. Yes, I think it'd be naive to think that there isn't, and I'm not being disrespectful, by the way, but it's a bit like saying, do you think Roger Federer's record of, you know, is he the greatest, or who's the greatest, Rod Laver or anything else, you know, like in any sporting pursuit, will that record ever be broken? Of course it will. I think it will. You know, it's naive to think that it won't. Take, for example, the Painted Hills in South Australia, which is south of William Creek. So we run a workshop in Lake Eyre every year. And in fact, last year we ran about eight of them, right? Because they had so much water in it. There's a place south of William Creek, which is in the middle of nowhere, by the way, which has the most incredible landscape. And only the last few years has it really been opened up and been known to other people other than locals that this place exists, you know? And that place is easily accessible from the air. And yet there's other places that are probably far more remote than that we just don't know about yet, that we'll still discover, and they'll come up on a radar, and all the landscape photographers will go, oh my God, get me there. You know, in the bird watching circles, there was this parrot called the night parrot that for 100 years they'd thought to be extinct. And then this guy of about 4 or 5, 6, 7 years ago went and found them and took photographs of them live. And now we study them. And you know, this bird that we sort of kind of thought might be out there, and they'd found dead carcasses by the side of the road and things like that, but no one had actually ever seen it or photographed it live before, all of a sudden gets found, you know? So yeah, it's exciting to think that there's places here in Australia even that haven't been photographed yet.
So you think, going on that, do you think they'll ever find and photograph the Yeti?
Sam Squatch.
Who knows? Perhaps you could be the photographer who comes up with that amazing. Well, it's funny. It's funny you mention this because I do a lot of driving, as I've said, and I had a project that I was working on for quite some time there on the snow landscapes of Australia. And with that, I would drive back from these places like the Snowy Mountains in New South Wales. I'd drive back in the middle of the night to get home sometimes. And I've always dreamed and always thought that I should have my camera beside me on the passenger seat because I've always put it out there to the universe because I'm a big believer that, you know, if you ask, the universe provides, that I would find a Tasmanian tiger there right in front of me as I'm driving along and that I'd be the photographer to get that shot, right? That's that's going to be my claim to fame more than anything else. Well, a few years ago, I'm coming back from the Snowy Mountains, and this happens to me without a word of a lie. It's during the day, it's not at night, and I come around this bend in a remote sort of country area, and this animal runs across the road that all I can describe it looking like is sort of like hyena-ish. It had these back legs that were shorter than the front legs. It had this like fox-like tail, and then it had this head on it like a dingo, and it runs up the embankment on the side, and as I go past it 100 kilometres an hour, I look at him and he looks at me, or she, and we look each other in the eyes, and I'm like, what the hell are you? It was just, and it had this dingo head on it, this body like a hyena, and then this tail on it like a fox. It was unbelievable. It was the closest thing I've ever got to perhaps seeing a Tasmanian tiger. They're definitely out there. It's my fate to
play rock. But you didn't get a shot, though.
I got a shot with my eye. That's the most important.
But I tell you what, if you'd gotten a shot, it would have been out of focus anyway. All those shots.
I tell the story, right? I've told this a few times where when I left my sports photography job, which was my first professional job back in 2001, I worked as a professional sports photographer for 3 years with this sports agency here in Melbourne, which was an awesome introduction to photography. It was my first professional gig and I learned heaps. And I got to travel the world and I even went to the Sydney Olympics to photograph that, which was amazing. I left the job and for 2 weeks I went to Central Australia to get this out of my system of photographing landscapes, right? And I walked for a week through the Larapinta Trail, which is in the West MacDonald Ranges. Great little spot. And the first night I'm out and about, camping by myself, and I really get anxious when I'm camping by myself. That period where the sun goes down and me actually getting to sleep, I get highly anxious for some reason. I don't like being out on my own in the wilderness, which is ironic because I actually go by myself. And I'm camped in this dry creek bed, and it's summertime. It's stinking hot, and I haven't even got the fly in the tent. It's just netting. And in the middle of the night, nature calls. So I say to myself, right, I've got to go and, you know, do a wee, as you do. And it's so hot, and most of the time I don't wear any PJs anyway. So I'm standing in the middle of the desert. Yeah, doesn't this paint a beautiful picture for you? Sorry, guys. Turn off for the next couple of minutes if you don't want to hear this. And I'm standing there, stark naked, doing a wee, looking down at the ground. And the next thing you know, my shadow is on the ground, like bright as can be, like there's daylight on me. Like the police helicopter is flying over the top of me with a spotlight going, excuse me, sir, you can't do that. Put that away.
We've all been there.
It wasn't that big. Oh. You know, you're pretty self-conscious when you're taking a bush wee anyway. Mm. But I'm standing out there, middle of nowhere, pretty anxious that I'm out in the middle of nowhere in the first place, but my shadow is in the ground. I look up and this meteorite is streaming towards that. The ground and so close. It was probably, it felt like it was a kilometer away. Maybe it was more, maybe it was less. It felt like I could reach out and touch it. Just before it hits the ground, it blows up, it loses its light, etc. I'm just like, oh my God, how is that? Wow. By the same token, I'm shitting my pants. I ran back to my tent. I think I curled up in the fetal position for about an hour before I went to sleep because I swore aliens were going to come and, you know. But to this day, I've told that story. And only a few years ago, I was at a camera club and somebody said to me, did you get a photo of it? Did you have your camera out?
Yeah, it's impossible.
If I did, what are the chances? And even if I did, it would have been blown out to all proportion. You can't predict that.
No, exactly.
Exposed for it.
Yeah.
I was exposing for it, but just in a different way.
Definitely overexposed.
Those sorts of experiences that you have, it's a Walter Mitty type moment, isn't it? It's that sort of like, I don't need a camera to have recorded that, and I wouldn't have done it justice anyway. And I've got that in my memory forever in a lifetime.
Yeah, unfortunately, so have we.
Yeah, particularly the
Think of the meteorite. Don't think of anything else.
But but you know, if you had a camera with you and you were good to go, that wouldn't have happened. It's like that old question. Like if a tree falls down in the in the forest. You know, has it
actually,
has a bear shat on it?
Has it actually happened?
And with UFOs and Sasquatch and all that sort of stuff. If you got a camera, it's just not going to happen.
And that Tasmanian tiger that you saw, it sounds like something that would come out of Tasmania with a weird head and short legs.
I'm glad you're saying this and not me. You've just alienated all of your Tasmanian audience, Christian. Well done.
No, only the photographers.
Okay.
Oh, they're the only ones that listen. That's right. Yeah. Oh, damn.
There's a great bunch of Tasmania photographers down there, aren't they? I can understand why they make Tassie their home. I mean, you can photograph that location any time of year and it looks good.
Yeah, it is amazing. But I mean, look, you're so close to it as well. I mean, you can get on a plane and be there in less than an hour. Although you can't get out of the state though, because you guys are all riddled with COVID.
You can't you're not allowed to go to Tasmania either, are you?
No.
Wow.
Oh, that's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
I think we'll keep the Victorians in their box.
Yep.
And then us, where's Aussies, which we live in, 1/3 of the country.
Well, I mean, we're used to isolation anyway, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You guys have never had it better. You're so happy that you get to, tell everybody else, don't come near us.
It's great.
Yeah.
That's the way you like it.
It's true.
We get a Sugarloaf Rock to ourselves every day of the week. We can go to Sugarloaf and take the same photo as everyone else has taken and a million times. And what's your thoughts on that, mate, on unique, interesting images? Do you like, everyone goes out and gets their trophy shots.
Yeah.
And I think there's nothing wrong with that. And I've done that and I do it repeatedly. But, when you go out shooting, do you get your trophy shots first and then?
Let me answer this way. I've run many workshops in New Zealand and we've even stayed many times in Wanaka.
Oh, no.
And I refuse to take my group to the Wanaka
trip. Oh, thank God. Thank you, Tom.
I say to them, if you want to go and do it, off you go, but we're not going. I'm just not going to be in that lineup. I just don't see the point of getting the same shot as everybody else. I like to... I think it's more this. I think it's more that, for me, landscape photography, and I hope you guys relate to this as well and many of the listeners, I don't want to go out and be in the landscape with everybody else, regardless of whether I'm taking photographs or not. I want to be out there because I love being in the wilderness and I feel like I'm the only one out there, or perhaps the only one who's ever stood on top of that mountain or whatever it might be. There's such solace and there's such a sort of meditative state that you can be in, and that feeling of, the House of Serenity, all the rest of it, right?
Yeah.
Carrying your camera with you is a bonus because you get to record it. But I don't want to be standing in a lineup with 50 other photographers and jostling for the same shot. It's just not it.
No. It is. It's kind of a cringy thing to do. And it's a shame that, it's like surfing. It's like all these things that become really popular. You get to a location and you're like, oh damn, there's other photographers here. It's like when you go surfing, oh damn, there's 20 guys in the water, how am I going to get that wave? And you're all fighting for that one secret little spot where the angle's the best. It gets frustrating. I would much rather be off somewhere that is less photogenic but more interesting to and gives you more of a challenge to try and photograph and to create something from that. So,
100%. And I guess that's why I love aerial abstract landscape photography as well, is that for many reasons, but that reason that you really do feel like you're capturing something that perhaps hasn't been recorded before, which is really nice. But obviously, too, I love it from a commercial point of view because, clients can walk into the gallery here and go, oh my God, what is that? Like, where is that? Is that a painting or a photograph? Those sorts of questions. It feels far more artistic to me than anything else. And I'm not the first or the last to, shoot aerial abstracts. Christian, you've been doing it for years and you do it extremely well. But, it's something that I really enjoy doing, so I'll keep doing it.
Mate, with your aerial stuff, do you look for a pattern on the ground, or do you just shoot the thing and just, get it back to the studio later and go, oh, okay, well, that's a little bit interesting there,
Yeah.
What do you look for, mate?
I guess if you were to look at all of my aerial photographs, you'd see some sort of pattern in through those. But when I'm shooting, I'm not looking for anything particular. I'm using my intuition to say, oh, that looks interesting, or that would make a good photograph.
Yeah, right.
Versus it has to be certain colours or shapes or patterns or lines or anything like that. I use my natural instinct, which I think, you know, I've been blessed to have, which I've had, I believe, all my life, which is I know what looks good at a photograph, so then I'll photograph that. So there is one sort of common theme that I find through a lot of my aerial photographs, and that's diagonal lines. I tend to really love diagonal lines through my photographs. It creates a really interesting dynamic. So that's probably the one thing that you'd see. But anything else, it's like, wow, that looks interesting. I'll take a photograph of that. It's colorful, or it's got interesting lines, shapes, patterns, things like that.
Actually, I'm looking at your website now, mate, and looking at your the category, the best-selling prints category.
Yes.
And there's only one aerial photo in there.
So that's because it's not that. It's my aerial photographs are in the other section, which is shop limited edition prints. And so you'll see those in there where you see all of my aerial shots and my best work, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So the other section that you're looking at there now is more the stuff taken from the ground.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I love your aerials. They're beautiful, mate. And have got some awesome. I mean, how good are Salt Lakes, hey? I mean, where would we be without Salt Lakes and salt farms?
Salt Works and all the rest of it. I say to clients that come in here, I say, if I had all the money in the world, I would take, you know, 3-6 months off and travel the world and just photograph Salt Works, you know, Utah and Bolivia and all other places. They really make such an interesting subject. And, you know, we're fortunate that we've got a few here in Australia. I've done some in Walvis Bay in Namibia. But there's plenty of other places I'd love to go and photograph. They're so interesting. I know they're highly destructive, but by the same token, they make for great patterns and shapes and colours, that's for sure.
Yeah, there's one up past Carnarvon. Lake something or other. What is it?
Lake McLeod.
McLeod.
There's one in the top of Lake McLeod. Yeah.
Have you been over that? Have you flown over that one?
I haven't. No. Scotty, our good friend Scotty McCook has. He chartered a plane from Carnarvon or Shark Bay and has done it.
Yeah.
No, I'm yet to experience that one, unfortunately.
Yeah, that one looks really nice. There's some great stuff around, and I think we're lucky here in WA. We got a lot of amazing salt lakes and salt
you guys farms. Are the aerial capital of Australia. You're the state of Australia that everyone, if they want to shoot aerials, should be in.
We definitely have from Shark Bay to all the coastline and then all through the wheat belt and stuff. There's some really cool things.
I mean, I follow quite a few international aerial photographers, and you guys have had people come from the States and from Europe, etc., and they've come to specifically shoot places like Shark Bay, Useless Loop, you know, those goldfield areas that you've been talking about. You know, there's a guy called Tommy Hagen. He came out recently. Tommy Clark from the UK, he came out and shot Shark Bay, etc. They're making specific trips to come out and shoot aerials in WA. So
isn't that amazing? It's just so cool that we've got all that at our fingertips. So if you had a choice of aerials, would you prefer a natural scenes or like Lake Eyre, or would you prefer have you done any built up man-made aerial stuff?
I'm not as big on the sort of built up urban aerial landscapes. I'm more the outback sort of landscapes or the more natural ones. I'd probably favour more of the natural landscape rather than the anything sort of man-made.
Yeah, and do you use a drone, or it's all shot from Cessna's helicopters?
I do. My next book that I'm about to press print on is 50% drone and 50% from light planes and helicopters, which surprises me because it wasn't supposed to be that way. We've sort of shied away from using drones for aerial photography here because the limitations of blowing them up to sell them commercially here in the gallery, right, as artwork. But obviously they're getting better, and software is very good at blowing them up, as we know. And so this latest book, I decided to shoot the summer on Mornington Peninsula. So we did a book on the Mornington Peninsula last year that sold out. And so this one is a sort of sequel that's called the Mornington Peninsula Summer Edition. And I shot it over 4 weeks over the summer, just last summer now. And I shot a lot from light planes, helicopters, etc. But then I felt there were a few pictures that were missing that I couldn't get from planes or helicopters because we'd be too high. So I specifically went out with my drone and shot some others. And yet I found, you know, obviously it's a cheaper option than hiring planes and helicopters, and it can sometimes be easier to shoot with a drone with its steadiness, etc., and the way you can manipulate it to get into that perfect position. So in the end, 50% of the book, there's about 100 pictures, 50 of them have come from drones, which is which is interesting, surprised me. And and you know, with a book that's, it's similar sort of format and size to your latest book, Christian, you know, the quality I'm hoping will be fine for that publication.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that book's got some, definitely got some drone shots in there. And, you know, I'm finding that even just with my Phantom 4 Pro, I think the biggest print I've done with that, 66 inches by 44 inches. Wow. So that's a pretty reasonable size print and actually looked half decent, you know, that single
capture. And what software are you using to blow that up into, for the interpolation?
PhotoZoom Pro 8 I'm using. Yeah, right. But there is that gigapixel AI or whatever it is. But
Have you used that?
I had to play with the trial version, but I was getting this different. It was doing something weird to the color, and I couldn't work out why. But I'm probably just not using that right. But is that what you use?
I've used it here. Yeah, I did a comparison a few months ago of that versus Photoshop, for example, and it's worked very well. Better than Photoshop if you're blowing things up from small to big. And we've got one print here in the gallery taken with my former drone, which was the DJI Mavic Pro, not the Mavic 2. And so that was only 12 megapixels. And look, when you go up close, it breaks up a bit. But this is a print that's, you know, 120 centimeters by, you know, 150 centimeters. So you're not standing right close to it in order to appreciate it. You're standing 3 meters back or so, and you wouldn't know that it's from a drone.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me about the gallery experience, Matt. Are you enjoying the having your own gallery?
I think it's the hardest thing I've ever undertaken. And what I mean by that is, I know you've had Scotty Lego on the podcast, and he seems to be doing a very good job of it selling there, because he's just as good a businessman in my mind as he is a photographer, right? And that's what it takes. You know, you can't just open a gallery and have pretty pictures on the wall and expect they're going to sell themselves. I mean, it's probably more of awareness than anything else. It's making sure that people know that you've got a gallery and that you've got artwork for sale and that it's decent art and they're going to love it and all the rest of it. So I think where I'm at with my career is that, as a good friend of mine said to me probably a couple of years ago, he didn't say stop taking photos. He said, you don't need to shoot more pictures. You need to start selling some. And it's totally true. At the end of the day, if I got hit by a bus tomorrow, I'd like to think that this would continue on for many more years, that Mary and the family would continue to sell this artwork. There's so much of it. You know, there's so much of it available. We've got over 200 of those pictures as limited edition prints in that aerial abstract series. There's over 1,000 other photographs on the website, plus, you know, whatever else is in my archives and on my hard drives. The challenge for me now is to become more and more and educate myself more and more as being a good business person and less, you know, trying to refine my craft as a photographer. Because I know that I can take a half-decent picture. Now the challenge is being more entrepreneurial and selling the stuff.
A lot of photographers you speak to will say to you, I can't figure out how to sell my work. Tom Putt, how do you sell your work?
This is the $64 million question. And I'm not the best to answer it, because I'm in no way killing it here and in no way leading the pack or anything like that. You know, we're selling some art, which is great. But by the same token, we know that there's so much more we can do, and that's the challenge for us in the future. I think if you're wanting to, there's so many different avenues in which to sell your artwork, and I think it just depends on what you want to achieve. I mean, there's things like, I think the worst thing that people can think is that if they get a decent website or spend some money on somebody putting together a website for them, they're going to sell stuff. And I mean, I've probably fallen into that trap as well. I can't tell you, I've had an e-commerce website since the, you know, late 90s, I think, you know, at least 20 years. And I've probably sold half a dozen to a dozen things over the internet in that time. You know, is that my fault? Is that because people don't know that it's available? Or is it more that people want to come into a gallery and physically see the artwork first? Is it a price point issue? I believe somewhat it is. I think people will spend a couple hundred dollars on artwork over the internet because it's a relatively safe purchase. If they decide they don't like it, or the quality's not good, or a product doesn't arrive, oh, well, I've only blown a few hundred dollars versus thousands of dollars. And most of our artwork is in more the sort of $2,000 to $3,000 or more. And so I think the worst thing, as I said, is that you can think to yourself, oh, I'll get a website and that'll mean that I start selling my art. Mm-hmm. Because the people have got to know about it in the first place. Not everybody jumps on the internet and says, right, let's type in landscape photography for sale or landscape photography artwork, and all of a sudden your name comes up. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they did, that's going to be rare, and rarer still that your name comes up on the first page of Google that you actually get, you know, seen by somebody. Mm. I think it's things like, you know, selling at local markets, for example, yeah. if that's your thing. Mm. What else could you do? I've had a blank, you know.
I guess the reason...
Ideally, you'd have your own gallery, but not everybody has the money or wants to stand in a gallery, you know, 7 days a week and sell their own artwork. There's a commitment there as well.
Well, it's interesting you brought up Scott Lego, because he, you know, he's a brilliant photographer and he's a great business person. Mm. And I guess the reason, you know, I'm asking you this is a lot of photographers, when they start doing landscapes, they are a bit dismayed because they're like, okay, well, I've got this work, you know, I think it's pretty good. My mates say it's pretty good and that sort of stuff, but I just can't sell it. So it's almost, in a way, you know, it's... God, I've gone blank too, but that's the commercial reality of it for that person at that time is you know, not necessarily a reflection on the quality of their work.
100% no. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and you look at we take the Mickey out of Peter Lick, and Peter, if you're listening, you know, we meet it with love, and I risk my life to take these photographs. I love it, but you know, he's just an incredible marketing machine. I mean, Peter is a great photographer. I'm not a massive fan of his style, but he's a marketer, and you know. Like you said with Scott, I mean, that's, you know, that's at least 50% of it, isn't it?
It's 90% of it. I reckon, you know, you've got to be a business person who's a photographer rather than a photographer who's a business person. Because I think 90% of it is being a business person and marketing yourself versus the 10%, which is the photography. I mean, there's plenty of brilliant artists out there who are dead broke or don't make a dollar out of their art versus...
Most of them.
There's a number of people out there, most of them, that's right, yep. Versus there's a number of people out there who are great business persons or are business savvy who are selling probably not the best art. And that's because they're good at what they do in terms of getting their name out there and marketing themselves, that's for sure. I mean, Peter Lick's work, you know, it's not the best photography out there, landscape photography out there, but it's very saleable. And I think his earlier work is outstanding. I'm not such a big fan of his more recent work, but at the end of the day, he knows how to sell it, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Good on him.
Yeah, and that is really important. And it's good to see the government making it kind of make it harder for artists to go to university now and study fine arts degrees now, double the price. And yeah, so we're up against it as artists, you know, because, you know, it's a lot of people see creating art as a great way to spend your day, and some people are wired for it and some people aren't, and some people are happy to be an accountant, some people want to be photographers or painters or musicians. And I think art gives so much to us, to people. It'd be a real shame to never see it and never have galleries and have people creating this incredible work.
I think that's a good point, Christian, because at the end of the day, you know, when I opened the gallery and we put a little bio on the wall, I got Mary to read it and she said, "Nah, you're not hitting the mark. You've got to have your why up there." And I said, what do you mean? She said, "What's your reason for doing this? Not the opening gallery, more what's your reason for taking photographs in the first place?" And I said, "I don't know, I just like creating pretty pictures." And she said, "Nah, it's not bad. It's bigger than that." And I joked and I said, "What do you mean? Anything bigger than me?" But but she said, "You know, there's a reason why you do it more than anything else." And for me, it is about, you know, I think making people aware that we have these beautiful places out there. You know what I mean? It is a matter of me creating art. That's something that I love to do. But then also too, being that conduit between the landscape that's out there and the people who come in here and admire the artwork, and in your gallery as well, Christian, we're bringing awareness to people that in fact these places exist. And, you know, there might be an ulterior motive of obviously wanting to protect those places, which is what we all want, I would hope. But at the end of the day, I've lost my train of thought again. You know, it's it's to me about being that person who is fortunate that I've made this my career, although it's been a choice, of course. But then I get to be able to go to places, amazing places, take good photographs, and then bring them to people who perhaps wouldn't have the time or the money, et cetera, to even know of these places in the first place. So that's, I think, a nice gift to have.
Yeah, it is nice to bring awareness to the beauty of nature, and hopefully, and it, you know, it always sounds a little bit kind of wanky when you say, oh, you know, I hope everyone gets something from these photos and it inspires you to look after nature and that. But it does sound wanky, but it is kind of a thing that we, you know, I think if you really do care about the environment, you hope that people would get inspired to look after it, or to go out and see it for themselves and not trash it and have a bit more respect for it.
100%.
You know, and that's you know, admittedly, we try to make living from photography, and we create our living from photographing nature and making, you know, these pretty pictures. So there's a bit of a, you know, we're kind of responsible for an increase in tourism to these areas, which may be bad for it, you know. But I don't think you're ever going to stop any of these sort of things happening. But, it, you know,
well, who knows?
If you've got a photograph of some area that's about to get a dirty great big, you know, mine, coal mine through the middle of it, you know, you hope that your photography will counter that argument that it's a good thing to do.
Fletch, can I ask you a question? You did some photography quite recently of a lithium mine, which was an amazing photo. But I noticed you got criticised online for that.
As he should.
Yeah, as I should.
I didn't even see that criticism.
It was along the lines of how can you love the environment and then, you know, make a living from taking a photo of a lithium mine?
They're not linked.
I know, it's just linked. Stupid. But, you know, I mean, what do you reckon about that, Fledge?
Yeah. Well, you know, I can understand that, because people see me do one thing and then say another thing. And look, I'm not, and I've always said I'm not anti-industry, anti-mining, and definitely I'm not against the people that work in the industries that, you know, everyone makes their living a certain way. Some people make their living digging stuff up. I make my living, if I can make my living taking photos of stuff that's been dug up, then, you know, I'm doing what they're doing. We're just trying to
get by,
put food on the table, blah, blah, blah. But look, I find those things quite interesting to photograph, and I love photographing industry and, you know, all that stuff that's related to it. I think, man, it's incredible what they can do. But where I have problems is when these big multi-corporations, you know, care more about the profits than the people that work for them and for the environment, that, you know, they're taking these resources that are finite and with little regard to the future of everything, you know, of our existence. So some of those things annoy me. But yeah, I don't
because you take a good, because you take a good photograph of a mine site doesn't mean that you're endorsing what they're doing. At the end of the day, you're just creating art, you know.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what it was when I was there. It was like I did think too much. And look, I've got an electric car, so I like lithium. It goes nicely in my batteries. So
that's right. How much destruction was done by the environment in order for you to have that lithium battery in your car?
Huge. And look, I admit I'm a hypocrite, and I'm like everyone else. We can't stop
Nobody's
living.
Nobody's perfect, you know.
Yeah.
No, we don't live in a perfect world, but we can at least try and minimise the environmental impact that each of us has. And we're in this day and age, we're probably better off than any other society in terms of the way we care about the environment. Mm. You know, go back 100 years or 200 years and see the destruction that we were doing in the environment back then versus what we're doing now. I think it's easy to focus on the 10% that's wrong. Well, let's take the 80-20 principle, which hopefully everyone knows about. The 20% that we're doing wrong versus the 80% that we're doing extremely well in order to protect the environment, the reduction in plastics and all that sort of stuff. There's a lot of good stuff being done, but it's easy to get caught up in the whole, politics, you know, armor of the sky's falling. and sensationalise that, which is what the media is very good at doing also.
But do you know what? You know, Tony just has put it the best way I've ever I've ever heard. He put it best and said, look, even if you don't believe in climate change and that sort of stuff, and there's a lot of people that don't, is it really going to hurt to, you know, look after the environment anyway? Like, how is that going to come back and haunt us if we try not to smash the place?
It's true. I'm not sure that I believe in climate change, which is fine, but it's the bigger picture is more about let's stop polluting the planet as much as we are, regardless of whether climate change
exists
or not.
How can that hurt? That can't hurt.
That's what we should all be doing.
Yeah.
Don't give me the argument of whether climate change exists or not. Mm. At the end of the day, let's stop polluting the place as much as we're doing.
Yeah.
And then exactly. And then we'll all be happy, won't we?
Yeah.
You know, the climate change activists will be happy, and you and I who care about the environment, we're happy. It's a win-win.
The animals will be happy.
Everybody's happy.
The poor old animals, they're the ones that suffer the most. But anyway.
I wanted to reverse back a step before we go on or wrap up or whatever you're planning on doing. The Instagram thing and that whole debate about, you know, these places being overtaken by millions of tourists, etc. I see, and I'm not sure if this is the case, but these days there's a bit of a movement, I guess, around not specifically tagging places on social media so that it doesn't get overrun by a million and one people, which I like the sound of. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Well, you just go photograph places that no one wants to go to. It's like, even if it's a good photo, it's like, yeah, I don't want to go there. That's why I love the wheat belt, because no one wants to go to the wheat belt. It's got
it's too bloody hot most of the time.
Yeah, 6 months of the year it is. Yeah. So what's up for you, mate? What's the future? You've got some workshops starting to come out soon, or probably not now, because you're
Everything's been on hold. I think this has got to be the quietest year ever for photography workshops my time. We've done one. We went to Russia to Lake Baikal back in February. We just got that done before everything got locked down. We've started our one-day workshops up here on the Mornings Peninsula again. We're going to run our annual snow photography workshop up at Mount Hotham Dinner Plain in late July, early August. And then hopefully we'll be able to travel interstate and do other things. I'd love to get back up to Lake Eyre and shoot up there and run a workshop up there soon, and Shark Bay, etc. But we're probably looking realistically at running all our workshops domestically in 2021. I don't like the idea of either us being allowed allowed, I guess, to travel overseas in 2021. Nor,
mate, it's not going to happen. It's just not going
to
happen.
To do that, you know, like we've had several cancellations for our Lake Baikal workshop next year that may or may not go ahead because people have said, regardless of whether you're going or not, we're not coming. So, and that's I understand entirely. It's disappointing for me and for them. But at the end of the day, there's no point running a workshop to somewhere if people are all just going to say, no, we're not going. We're not going to the States. We're not going to Russia. We're not going, you know, here, there, or anywhere. It's not safe to do so. And we wouldn't put our clients at that risk anyway. So, you know, it'll be great to explore more places locally in 2021. Mm. There's plenty of workshops that we've looked at running here in Australia that we just haven't had time to do. So we'll put those all on the agenda for next year.
And it's nice doing it in your own country because a lot of it, you know, it's fun, it's cheaper. You don't have to get on a plane and fly somewhere. There goes, you know, $4,000 each or whatever if you're – well, probably 10 grand for you because you probably fly business most of the time, Tommy, I'm sure.
Listen to you. As opposed to you and your private Learjet, Christian.
Wouldn't that be nice? See, if you had a private Learjet, you could take off in Melbourne, fly the WA, fly over Shark Bay, get your aerial shots, and then fly back and never land.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's brilliant.
This is it. Well, why didn't I think of it sooner?
Yep. Just get that jet fueled up, baby, and off you go.
And I'll have a chat with the pilot as soon as I get off this call.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll word him
up. He's at the airport right now with the engines just ticking over, burning a bit of gas. Yeah. So the workshops. What about other projects, mate? Are you doing anything
I've got this new book coming out that will hopefully be in the gallery in time for Christmas. I mean, you know, from a business point of view, it's a great product to have. You know, when you've got a book that's $50, $60, $75 or more that is sitting here in the gallery, you know, if people don't want or can't afford an artwork but they like the look of your book, it's a great product to have.
Yeah.
And there's a million and one other book projects that I've probably delayed in doing, and the Snow Landscapes of Australia book is one of them that I've mentioned that I finished years ago that we haven't published commercially. So maybe the profits from this latest book will help us print that. Yeah. Or if anybody's listening and wants to be a silent investor, that would be good too. What else is happening? What other projects? You know, nothing that I can think of really. That, you know, it's head down, bum up, keeping.
And yet, any other hobbies that you have besides? I mean, I know you're into your fitness and stuff. You do a bit of swimming and riding. You're getting out on the bike. You're doing any of that?
I haven't been out on the bike for weeks, which I miss. And I do try and stay reasonably fit. I use that as, you know, like my workshop participants who come along have often told me that they love coming away, or they love photography because they find it very meditative and they relax and they forget about, you know, the career or life or anything else that they've got going on in their mind for a while. And it's the same for me for exercise. You know, some of the best ideas I've actually come up or for my businesses over the years have come from me being out paddling on the bay, you know, and all of a sudden I've thought, oh, well, why don't we try that? That could possibly work, you know, or you're out on the bike. I know you're the same, Christian. You love getting out on the bike and clearing the head and all the rest of it. And it's the same for me, although I'm not doing as much of it as I should. I'm one of these people that I like to fill up my day every minute of the day. And if I'm really gung-ho on something in the gallery or the business, I'll try and get into the gallery as early as possible to knock that over or to continue with it. I get very enthusiastic about things and push everything else aside sometimes. So like getting this book to print ASAP is consuming me, just wanting to make sure that I can finish that off and get that done in time and there'll be a time for the exercise and other things. But no, I'm one of those guys who's made a career out of my hobby, which most people advise you not to do. But you know, I still love it, so I'll still continue to do it. One thing I did remember that I was going to mention there about, you know, you were talking about selling art. One video or one movie that I'd love everyone to take a look at if they're interested in selling their art in the art world is one called The Price of Everything. It came out last year or the year before on HBO in the States, but it's available on YouTube. You can watch it there. The Price of Everything. It's a great expose into the art world and art collectors and artists, et cetera, trying to make a living out of selling their art. And there's an art critic on there who is a very likable kind of guy, and he gets asked by the producer, you know, what advice would you give to anybody out there wanting to make a living out of their art? And he basically says, let's face it, 99.999% of artists out there don't make a living out of their art. So my advice to anyone who wants to make a living out of art, photography, what have you, he said, don't do it unless that's absolutely the thing that you have to do above anything else in the world. You know, like, you can't see yourself doing anything else but being an artist, then you should do it. But if you're like, oh, I like it, and I like the idea of, you know, traveling the world, taking photographs, being a Christian Fletcher or Tom Putter or Tony Hewitt or anything else, they're like, no, don't do it. Find something else that's going to make you money and then leave that on the side as a bit of a hobby, because you will more than likely make far more money out of that than you would your art.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. And every year, there's probably thousands of people come out of art school and TAFEs and photography courses all over Australia, and realizes there's not really much in the way of work for them.
And not only do you have to produce pretty good art, but you need to be willing to work for yourself and, you know, get up every day and love what you do about selling your art as well. It's not a matter of just, you know, saying, oh, well, I'm going to get up today and I'm going to, you know, give it a bit of a go. You've got to do that every day, year after year after year. And
you've got to be able to. And a lot of times, 7 days a week too, you know, and long hours.
I work all the time. I go home from the gallery, I have dinner and I'll sit on my laptop, or I'll read business books or work on a project, and I just don't stop working.
Yeah, no, that's right. And that's what it takes, I think, to be successful.
Because we love it too.
Exactly.
I thought you were going to say that there are millions and millions of people coming out of art school wanting to be Christian Fletcher wannabes. I would have thought that's a given without having to say it.
Oh, boy. Why would you want that job? Jesus, mate.
I'm still striving.
You don't realize how hard my life is. You know?
Oh, listen to him as he kicks back, smoking cigars, drinking his whiskey on the rocks there.
Cognac.
Sitting on top of all of his Leica cash.
Don't mention the Leica. Don't mention Leica and cash in the same sentence, please.
Tom, mate, if anybody is interested in going on one of your workshops, and I reckon they should. How can they get in touch with you?
Well, we're booked out until 2025.
Oh, okay. Sorry. We'll just forget I said that.
I wish.
Christian Fletcher, if somebody wants to do one of your workshops.
Oh, there we go. We've got plenty of places going. Yeah, don't go to Tom's. He's full. Come to me.
Full.
I don't have any. I don't have any workshops, so you're okay.
They just need to jump onto tomputt.com. All the info's there on tomputt.com.